The Senora and her family are the closest to kin I have, I said.
And me?
He asked. You too, I said, wanting to announce that he came first.
We'll see, he said.
I thought of what Mimi had suggested in the stream the day after Joel had died. An eye for an eye, she had said. Did one only have to wish for it to make it true? What are you going to do with Puppy's wood? I asked.
What am I going to do with what wood? He asked.
This wood, I said, pointing behind him. The wood I gave you for Joel's coffin.
Congo didn't make use of it, he said. Maybe I'll keep it for the next time somebody dies.
He sat up and leaned against the gray cement wall, looked at the doorway through the scarred fingers laced over his face. Eve yawned loudly from outside, waiting for the right moment to come in and bed down for the night. Sebastian rose, put on his clothes, and walked me back out into the night. We said nothing to each other as we walked to Senora Valencia's house. On the way, we walked past the ravine where Joel had been buried. A fast breeze darted through the bamboo and lemongrass on either side of the road, blowing through them like a chorus of flutes and whistles. Felice was ahead of us on the road, pacing back and forth over the steep edge of the ravine. Her posture as she tipped towards the gorge reminded me of myself standing at the river's brim the day my parents had drowned. Sebastian and I accompanied Felice back to the gates of Doña Sabine's house. She went along with us, glad, I thought, to have been found. The next morning before dawn, while everyone was still asleep, Juana and I watched from the doorway of the old sewing room as Señor Pico padded his son's coffin with a pile of clean sheets from his wife's armoire and placed him in the casket. The señor was wearing his ceremonial khakis with his cap set in perfect alignment with his seashell-shaped ears. When he looked up, he seemed surprised to see Juana and me standing there.
You have not slept at all, señor, Juana reminded him. You should wake the señora now, he said.
Señora Valencia got up to drape a web of fragile lace over her son's colorfully painted coffin. Papi and one of the señora's maternal relations held the other end of the heirloom lace-bordered sheets, helping her to fold the cloth small enough to cover the casket without trailing onto the ground. Señora Valencia bent down to kiss the coffin through the sunflower design of the lace, and then walked back to her room. Her daughter was sleeping in her cradle. She picked her up and took her to her bed. Señor Pico and Papi together carried the coffin away. Once the casket was in the first automobile, Señor Pico came back to the bed where his wife sat with her daughter, cradled against her chest. He removed his cap and placed it between his right armpit and elbow. Brushing his lips against his wife's forehead, he avoided his daughter's tiny hand, which she intuitively held out towards her father as if in recognition of his face or to ward off the stinging expression of disfavor, growing more and more pronounced on it each time he laid eyes on her. Her gesture was like her own way of making amends for having lived in her brother's place, as if to say that she, too, wanted to be present for the burial and watch her brother's descent into the nothingness they had once shared as two.
Don't be anxious. Everything will go perfectly well.
Señor Pico assured his wife, as though he was discussing yet another military operation. Señora Valencia watched her husband march out of the room. As his packet pulled away, she covered her ears with both hands to protect herself from the noise. She then raised her daughter's face to her chin, closing her eyes to feel the child's breath against her cheek. Once Juana took over the care of Rosalinda, Señora Valencia defied Juana's commands to lie in and rest and went out to sit on the rocker on the veranda outside her room. The sun had just risen over the valley, the dew still lingering in the curved petals of Poppy's prettiest red lantern orchids. On the balcony, Señora Valencia made an altar for her son with two handfuls of white island carnations, which she chose and I fetched for her from her father's garden, and an unlit candle, which she had been saving to light in church after a mass. We watched as Father Woman hurried past the house, as though on his way to administer last rites somewhere. Soon after him, my friends came drifting by on their way to the fields. Congo led the group as usual, with Sebastian and Eve close behind. Señora Valencia leaned forward on the balustrade, as if to better see the orchids down below.
Amabel, you know some of the cane people.
Yes, Señora.
Go and ask them, the ones who just walked by, to come and have un cafecito with us. All of them? As many as will come.
I was breathless when I reached the almond tree road. A few ripe almonds had fallen off the branches. The seeds were cracked open, half buried in the soil. The broken fruits oozed a ruddy juice, which made it seem as though the ground was bleeding.
What's chasing you?
Sebastian asked.
The mistress of the house wants all of you to come for un cafecito with her, I said.
Your mistress? Sebastian asked.
Señora Valencia.
Congo raised his hand over his eyes and looked up at the house.
It is not a place where we want to go, Sebastian shouted into the hollow of Congo's ear.
Word of Señora Valencia's invitation passed from mouth to mouth in the group. Shoulders were shrugged. Eyebrows were raised. Burlap sacks and straw hats were removed from heads for a better look at the house. Discussions began and ended in the same breath. What did she want with them anyway? Maybe they were all going to be poisoned. Minnie had heard rumors of groups of Aiesians being killed in the night because they could not manage to trill their R and utter a throaty J to ask for parsley to say perejil.
Rumors don't start for nothing, someone insisted.
A woman began telling stories that she'd heard. A week before, a pantry maid who had worked in the house of a colonel for 30 years was stabbed by him at the dinner table. Two brothers were dragged from a cane field and macheted to death by field guards. Someone there had supposedly witnessed the event with his own eyes. It was said that the Generalissimo, along with a border commission, had given orders to have all Aiesians killed. Poor Dominican peasants had been asked to catch Aiesians and bring them to the soldiers. Why not the rich ones, too?
Tell me again the name of your mistress, Congo said.
Señora Valencia, I said. Her son is being buried this morning, so she may not be fully well. I tapped my temples to explain any rifts in the señora's reasoning. Congo dug his broom handle into the red dirt and started towards the house. Most of the cane workers continued on to the fields, but some, at least 20 or so, were curious enough to follow us up the hill. They crowded onto the porch into the garden, any place where there was room to either lean or sit down. Señora Valencia kept Rosalinda inside, while Juana and I followed her orders. We poured coffee into her best red orchid pattern tea set and passed the first cups to Congo, who handed them to the youngest in the group. Among the children was the boy I had given the goat bones to the night before. I poured him a full cup and then moved on to the others. Juana had rationed carefully, controlling the supply, so everyone who wanted to could have at least a sip.
We'll have the day's wages taken away if we don't go soon, Sebastian said. He did not want to participate in the senora's feast. As Juana was handing out the last cups of the coffee her sisters had sent her, Congo moved away from the others and walked boldly into the parlor where the senora was sitting with her daughter. Congo leaned over to peek at Rosalinda's bronze face. He held out his hand as if to touch it. Senora Valencia reached up and blocked Congo's hardened old fingers. Congo grabbed Senora Valencia's extended hand and kissed the tip of her fingernails. Senora Valencia's face reddened, as though this was the first time she'd ever been touched so intimately by a stranger. My heart is saddened for the death of your other child, Congo said in his best Spanish. He released her hand so that she could better grasp her daughter. When he died, my son, the ground sank a few folds beneath my feet. I asked myself, how can he die so young? Did the stars visit him upon me in caprice? To teach me that a lifetime can be vast as 100 years, or sudden as a few breaths? Enjoy this one you have left. It all passes so fast. In the time it takes to draw a breath. Senora Valencia watched as Congo walked out. I followed him with my eyes as he strolled down the hill. He laid his hand on Sebastian's shoulder as if to summon the strength for one more step. After everyone was gone, Senora Valencia went back to her bed and lay silently awake, watching her daughter sleep at her side. It seemed that she might have regretted exposing herself to the damp morning air and her daughter to outside forces that Congo and the others might have brought with them. But her son's death had made her heedless and rash. When her husband returned, before he could tell her anything about the burial, she told him what she had done for the cane workers. He did not scold her, but once he discovered that she had used their imported orchid pattern tea set, he took the set out to the yard and, launching them against the cement walls of the house latrines, he shattered the cups and saucers, one by one. 21. At Christmas, the hills beneath the citadel are full of lanterns. Parents and children join hands to light each other's faces by the glow of fragile paper, shaped to the desires of their hearts. A fanal, a lantern, is like a kite, my father says, a kite that glows but does not fly. My father always made me lanterns shaped like monuments, a task that took longer than most. The lantern of La Place Toussaint Louverture, with a candle glowing inside, the plumed feather-capped hat of General Toussaint, the cathedral of Cap Haïtien, with one set of paper used to dye another to look like stained glass, and of course the citadel, which takes 12 months of secret work. I say to my father, make me a lantern of your face to carry with me the whole year long. He laughs, a chortle of paternal pride. It would be too vain, he says, to spend more time than God reproducing oneself. 22. Rosalinda's baptism took place only after Senora Valencia's period of lying in had formally ended. On the baptism day, at the chapel, the pews were filled with a waiting brood of mothers, fathers, godmothers, aunts, and uncles. They had brought their children to Father Vargas for a group baptism. Many of the children were already 6 or 7 years old and were being rebaptized so the Generalissimo could now become their official, albeit absent, godfather. Señor Pico forced his way past the crowd, spilling over outside as his wife carried their daughter to the front row,
which was reserved for the more privileged families. Señora Valencia wore a pale cream dress with a mantilla, bordered with the same Valenciennes lace as the tablecloth that had been buried with her son. Papi followed behind her, then Dr. Javier and Beatrice. I watched from a distance as Father Vargas poured holy water on Rosalinda's head, welcoming her into the Holy Catholic Church. After the baptism, I gave my space to the family of a nearly grown boy whose name was about to be changed to Rafael in the Generalissimo's honor. Outside the chapel, the valley peasants waited for their turn before the altar. A few playful toddlers chased a baby goat around the church. Their mothers shouted threats that went unheeded. No supper for the rest of their lives, no sweets, no love, never again. The children, with the dust like a flying rug at their heels, were willing to hazard anything that might only be taken away from them later. When they came out of the chapel, Señora Valencia held Rosalinda out to me for a baptismal kiss.
Amabel, when you last saw her, she was a Moor, she said. Now, I bring you a Christian.
I leaned forward and grazed Rosalinda's cheeks with my lips. Her forehead was still wet where the priest had doused it with the holy water. Señor Pico yanked his wife's arm and pulled her away, almost making the señora drop the child. Rosalinda was startled by the abrupt movement and began to cry as they piled into the automobile for the short journey to the house. Juana cooked a giant baptism feast. We spent the afternoon serving the neighbors, those who came into the house and others, the valley peasants who gathered outside in curiosity and hunger. The celebration was stilled by the memory of Rafi, whose shadow would no doubt follow his sister all her life. That night, after the baptism celebration, Congo came to find me. He was wearing the yellow shirt and black pants that Sebastian had given him to dress his son for burial. The clothes fit him as though they had been cut and sewn for his body. "I am looking for Amabel," he said through the crack in the door. Running his fingers over the veranda rail, he stood outside in the night and listened to the tree frogs croaking. "Please come," I said. He eyed the pile of cedar that Puppy kept stacked near the latrines. "Let me stand here a moment," he said. "There's so much wood here. I've been on Sugarland all this country, and there's never enough wood to spare for us. I've seen people take doors off hinges to make coffins for their dead." He reached to the doorway and handed me a papier-mâché mold of a man's face. "I bring this offering for your house," he said. "I hope you will accept." I took the mask from him. The face hinted at his, but many decades earlier. The forehead was curved and wide, the raised cheekbones standing out above the hollowed space over the jaws. The lips were half open, between a grin and a scream. It was the death face of his son. I showed him to the mat where I prepared to sleep. He sat down. Picking up my conch shell, he blew into it, forcing out a clipped lively melody, a carnival rhythm. "You hungry?" I asked him. He yawned to show he was hungry without having to speak the words. I had some rice from the baptism meal that I had been saving for Sebastian. I removed it from three layers of plantain leaves and served it to him with a wooden spoon. "Back home, I earned my living making masks for carnival," he said between bites. "I was the only mask maker in my town. All I ever needed was a bit of flour and paper, and I could make this type of mask. Had a woman, 30 years she was with me, the mother of my son. She loved masks,
she did. The more of them I made, the more she seemed to love me.
I gave him a small calabash full of water. He pushed his head back and drank until it was empty.
At my age, my memory won't always serve me well, he said. Could be I knew you when you were young. Could be you're one of those children who ran and hid when my woman and I came down the street with our masks to open the carnival parade. Could be you climbed the greasy pole in my yard to get the money at the top. I always had a big celebration for the children at carnival. Naturally, one never remembers all the children.
What is your true name? I asked.
The name you had before you came here.
This was something I suddenly wanted to know. I was hoping that in the remembering, he would want to share this too.
Some things are too wasteful to remember, he said, like burning blood in an oil lamp.
His breathing grew louder, as though his stomach was getting used to being full.
After my woman died, I stopped the mask making to do carpentry. But I wasn't good at making anything but masks. I wasn't. Still, I couldn't bring myself to go back to the masks without my woman. I sold all my land. My money went on things I thought I could buy to forget. Mostly liquor, fire water, and happy people's company. Couldn't ever be alone when I was sad. Before you could tap your foot one time, I had nothing. Joel and I were used to working together, both he and me. We would have been beggars if we did not come here. But I'm not here only to eat your food and tell you tales. I came because Sebastian sent me.
Has something happened to Sebastian? I asked. Because of the baptism, I had not been able to go and see Sebastian all day.
Sebastian's well, he is, he said. He decided after what happened at the ravine that he didn't want to waste more time. He sent me to ask you if you would promise yourself to him and keep yourself just for him. When a young man's serious about a young woman, the old customs demand he bring his parents to express his intentions to her parents. Since both your parents and his parents are absent, I came to you on his word.
I looked down at the mask in my hand. I couldn't help but think of the night Joel had died. How for a moment, I'd thought it was Sebastian who had been struck down by Senor Pico's automobile. The old man glanced at me, and then at the mask.
Always hoped my son would find a woman like you, he said, a good woman.
Joel had a good woman, I said.
You think of that one with the big black mark under her nose. I did not want her for him.
She wanted your son, I said. She desired your blessings. She still does.
Blessings? What for? My son's only a remembrance now, if even this. The one with the big mark under her nose, she is young, and the young do not stay young by keeping watch on the past. Soon, she will find another man, and my son will slip from her mind.
She's still very troubled, I said.
I hope Sebastian will let you keep the mask, he said.
Are you certain you don't want to keep this face for yourself? I asked.
I've made many, he said, for all those who, even when I'm gone, will keep my son in mind. If I could, I would carry them all around my neck, I would, like some men wear their amulets. I give this one to you because you have a safe place to preserve it.
I'm happy to have it, I said. Though, happy is not the proper word.
I'm glad to give it to you, he said, though glad is also not the proper word.
Thank you for trusting me with something so precious to you, I said.
My son was precious to me, he said. This is only a sad reminder of him.
As he got up to leave, I straightened his collar and removed a clump of rice that was clinging to the top button of his shirt.
Now you look handsome, I said. Sebastian, he let me keep the clothes, he said. I put in some pleats and made them smaller.
I am happy you are the one to bring this word from Sebastian, I said.
I don't often have a chance to do these things, he said. I also had another thought when I came here tonight.
Tell me, please.
The elder of your house, Don Ignacio, he's not asked again to come and see me, no?
With Rafi's death, Papi did seem to have forgotten about him and Joel.
I'm not surprised, he said, that my son has already vanished from his thoughts.
After Congo left, I rushed out to see Sebastian. I didn't go the ravine route, but down to the footpath around the stream, which was a much cooler trail at night. It was a dark night, but I knew the trail well enough to follow it in my sleep. I dashed around the stream, listening to the tree frogs and the cicadas trilling from far away. I had been walking for some time when I heard the parting of tree branches and the flopping of footsteps landing in the mud holes behind me. The steps were faint at first, but slowly grew in force and concentration. They were coming closer, marching in perfect unison. Jumping off the path, I tried to slip into the stream but landed on my bottom with a splash. The night appeared clearer from the water. I reached down to the bed of the stream, feeling for a rock, something to use in defending myself. Looking back towards the footpath, I saw nobody there. Perhaps my fear had created all the noises.
You in the water!
A man's voice called from behind a shadowed tree. He spoke to me in Creole. I anchored my feet at the bottom of the stream, reached under, and finally grabbed a rock. Three men were standing at the causeway, each holding a machete, the blades reflecting the water's clarity.
This is a time to sleep, not to swim,
the same man said. I could see all their faces now. They were stonemasons who lived in the neighboring houses on the road leading to the stream. I walked out of the water, shivering as the night air dried my skin. Among the men was Inel, who had once rebuilt the latrines in Senora Valencia's yard. Inel handed me a blanket that he carried rolled up and tied with a rope on his back.
Where are you going at this late hour, Amabel?
He asked. To see Sebastian, I said.
Haven't you heard all the talk?
He asked. What talk?
Talk of people being killed.
That is just talk, started since Joel died, I said.
You should tell Sebastian to come for you when he wishes to see you at night, he said.
I walked back to the trail that encircled the stream. Inel rushed ahead as the others stayed behind me.
It's not prudent to walk alone these days,
Inel scolded. Thank you for your counsel, I said.
We want to protect our people, Inel said. After Joel was killed, we formed the Night Watchmen Brigade. If they come, we'll be prepared for them.
I am going back.
Another man spoke from behind me. I won't wait for things to go from talk to bloodshed.
I am going back to Haiti.
I won't take the automobile roads where all the soldiers are. I travel through the mountains. I'm going back this very Saturday. I'm prepared to leave all this behind. Thank you, Alegria. Our time here has been joyful, but now I must say goodbye to you.
I will stay and fight, Inel said. I work hard. I have a right to be here. The brigade stays to fight.
While we fight, we can help others.
All this because Joelle's been killed? I asked Inel. The coolness in my voice must have startled him, for he paused and looked at me before taking another step to follow his companions, who had left him behind. It wasn't that I had grown indifferent to Joelle's death, but I couldn't understand why Inel and the others would consider that death to be a herald of theirs and mine too. Had Signor Pico struck Joelle with his automobile deliberately to clear his side of the island of Aisians?
Let me ask again. Haven't you heard the talk?
Inel asked. I've heard too much talk, I said. When we reached the compound, I returned the blanket to Inel. He rolled it up, tied it with a short rope, and threw it back across his shoulder.
Thanks to her, if I am cold tonight, I have a wet blanket to wrap myself in, Inel told Sebastian as they shook hands. I will take this opportunity to warn the others, Inel said. The times have changed. We all must look after ourselves.
Inel and his men walked from shack to shack, cautioning everyone to be watchful, not to walk alone at night. He enrolled a few more sentries among the cane workers, some who promised that they would walk the valley with him the following night. Others joked that only a woman could get them out of their beds to walk the valley all night after they had spent a whole day on their feet in the cane fields. I hurried into Sebastian's room, my clothes dripping wet. Both Eve and Sebastian looked as though they'd been about to put out their lamp and go to sleep.
I thought Congo was still with you, Sebastian said.
Eve got up, stroked his shaved head, and went outside. I stepped out of my clothes but remained in my slip. Sebastian went out to hang my day dress to dry. When he returned, we lay down on his mat. He raised an old rice sack sheet over our bodies. I could feel his boils and the Sibylla poultice sliding down his leg as he called Eve back into the room.
Have you heard some talk? I asked Sebastian.
Inel's talking of an order from the Generalissimo.
Yes, that talk.
I don't know what to make of it, Sebastian said. I keep hearing it, but I don't know if all of it is true. Just before you came, we were speaking about you, Eve said, slipping back on his own mat across the room. Did your ears burn?
What were you saying? I asked.
Eve was telling me I should sell the wood, Sebastian said.
Puppy's wood?
We can sell it,
Eve said, twisting his neck and turning his large Adam's apple towards us.
I know someone who's looking for good, well-cured wood to make tables and chairs. I don't want this wood near me, Sebastian said.
Even though he was not speaking of the rumors, I could tell he was becoming as troubled as the others, distracted even.
Since we didn't use it for the reason we took it, I want to return the wood to its owner. There's no taking it back. Eve yanked a few sisal strands from the edge of his straw mat. Then it is your wood now, Sebastian said. I give it to you. It's yours to do what you wish.
Eve coiled his body into a ball and turned his back to us.
There's no taking it back, he repeated,
his voice already fading with sleep.
You sent Congo with word for me, I whispered to Sebastian.
There are plenty of men who would have made a promise to you long ago, he said.
Should we go to Father Woman for blessings? I asked,
becoming more and more impatient about being promised in a time-honored way to Sebastian.
I know you don't like priests and rituals, but Father Woman is our friend.
A piece of cooking wood held ajar the slat of lumber that served as Sebastian's window. The wood creaked as though about to fall. Sebastian got up and fixed it so the night air could freely enter and cool the room.
We may not live together in the same house, you and me, until the end of this harvest, he said. I don't want to bring you here, and I don't want to squeeze myself into your room on that hill and live with those people. Can you please wait for me?
I can wait, Eve shouted in his sleep. What can you wait for?
Sebastian asked him, laughing. We walked over to Eve's mat. His eyes were wide open, staring at the wall with a glaze over his pupils, like the cloudy gloss of river blindness. Sebastian waved his fingers in front of his face. Eve did not blink.
Ask him how he is, Sebastian said.
How are things with you, Eve?
I asked.
Who is asking?
Said Eve, still asleep.
I have known him since we were both in short pants, Sebastian said, as we walked back to his mat. I lived here in this room with him for many years. Never before has he talked in his sleep, plus with his eyes wide open. It started only after Joel's accident.
Eve and Sebastian both mumbled in their sleep all night, as though traveling through the same dream together.
Papa, don't die on that plate of food,
Eve said as dawn approached. He rolled onto his back, his eyes fixed on the dirty ceiling. His voice was clear yet distant, as though he were reciting a rote school lesson for the 100th time.
Papa, don't die on that plate of food. Please, let me take it away.
Sebastian turned over on his side and mumbled through his own nightmares.
Is he still talking?
He asked as he woke up. About his father dying on a plate of food, I said.
His mother liked to say that his father died over a plate of food, Sebastian replied in a wearied voice. The father was put in a bread and water prison by the Yankees and let go after 30 days. First thing done by the mother is to cook him all the rich food he dreamt about in prison. The father eats until he falls over with his face in the plate, and he's dead.
A cockscrow finally woke Eve. He jumped up and grabbed his work clothes, wanting to be among the first at the stream.
Did you have bad dreams last night? I asked Eve.
What do you want to know?
He asked, his Adam's apple bobbing up and down as though it were going to leap out of his mouth.
You want to use my dreams to play games of chance at Mercedes Stand.
We couldn't sleep, Sebastian said. You were squawking like a crazy parrot all night long.
After most of the workers had left for the stream, Sebastian and I went to a mud and wattle cooking hut near a wooden fence, where the compound met an open dirt road. He brushed two rocks against a dry pine twig and sparked a flame for our coffee. We sat under the mesquite that leaned over the hut, and while he sipped the coffee out of one side of his mouth, I watched him and grinned against my will. For some, passion is the gift of a ring in a church ceremony, the bearing of children as shared property. For me, it was just a smile I couldn't help, tugging at the sides of my face. And slowly as he caught glimpses of me between sips of his coffee, he returned the smile, looking the same way I did. Bashful, undeserving, and almost ashamed to be the one responsible for the look of desire always rising in a dark flush on the side of his face. His eyes searched everything around him, the live coals and ashes under the coffee pot, the pebbles opening the soil to fit themselves in, the patches of dirt-brown grass dying from being too often trampled underfoot. When the morning breeze lifted his torn and leaf-stained collar, he pressed it back down with his cane-scarred hands. His eyes surveyed all the familiar details of his fingers, pausing only for an instant when our pupils met, and trying to communicate with the simple flutter of a smile,
all those things we could not say, because there was the cane to curse, the harvest to dread, the future to fear. 23. I dream of the sugar woman again. As always, she is dressed in a long, three-tiered ruffled gown inflated like a balloon. Around her face, she wears a shiny silver muzzle, and on her neck, there is a collar with a clasped lock dangling from it. The sugar woman grabs her skirt and skips back and forth around my room. She seems to be dancing a kalanda in a very fast spin, locks arms with the air, pretends to kiss someone much taller than herself as she swings and shuffles. The chains on her ankles symbol a rattled melody. She hops to the sound of the jingle of the chains, which with her twists grows louder and louder. "Is your face underneath this?" I ask. The voice that comes out of my mouth surprises me. It is the voice of the orphaned child at the stream, the child who from then on would talk only to strange faces. "You see me?" she asks, laughing a metallic laugh that echoes inside the mask. "Why is that on your face?" I ask. "This?" She taps her fingers against the muzzle. "Given to me a long time ago, this was, so I'd not eat the sugar cane." I begin to think inside the dream that it is Sebastian who always brings her here, that she is the hidden image of some jealous woman or the revenant of some dead love he carries with him into my arms. "Why are you here?" I ask her. "Told you before," she says. "I am the sugar woman, you my eternity." I wake up, pounding the arm Sebastian has draped over my breasts to awake him. If I mumble in my sleep, it is either about my parents or the sugar woman. "What dream this time?" he asks. Sometimes he is impatient with my shadows. 24. The high cement walls around Doña Sabine's house were dotted with watchmen with deep brown peasant faces. Some looked too old, others too young to carry the ancient rusting rifles slumped over their shoulders, the holding straps digging flesh marks into their backs. As I walked by, I looked up at the high patio doors, where a small cloister of men and women crouched behind fragile curtains while watching passers-by on the roads. Closer to Señora Valencia's house, Luis was standing in the road, his head swinging back and forth with every movement, every bull cart or peasant merchant on donkey-back, every child on his way to the parish schools, every cane-cutter heading to the fields. "The patron is leaving today," he said, smiling. "They come for him in a short time." The patron had already stayed much longer than his expected time. His pressing operation, he had told his wife, had been delayed until now. Because we were all so accustomed to having the señora alone to ourselves, we preferred having him gone. Now I suspected the señor was tired of watching his daughter grow plumper and happier every day, while he was thinking of the male heir he had lost. "How long will he be gone?" I asked. He didn't know. A burning piece of metal breezed past my face as I walked up the hill. I jumped aside, ducking my head. Señora Valencia and her husband were standing under the flame tree, each holding a short-barreled rifle aimed at the calabash trees. The air was filled with a gust of peppery smoke, some of which came to rest in the back of my throat. I closed my eyes to fight the feverish sting in my pupils. "Amabel!" Señora Valencia cried out, her voice hoarse with terror. She was in a loose house dress, leaning against the flame tree for support. Señor Pico had on all of his uniform except his cap, which was resting on the far corner of the bench where his wife sat between shots. I waved my hand to show that I was still alive, and then ran into the pantry where Juana was peering out, annoyed.
I thought you'd caught the last one in your neck.
She handed me a cup of water.
Which saint must I thank for saving me?
All of them,
she said. Señora Valencia looked a bit depleted from the shooting, but she pulled herself together in time to fire again. Looking towards the house, she appeared worried that the rifle blasts might wake her daughter.
He should not make her do this, Juana said. Not so soon after she has given birth.
The señora's strong. She's a good markswoman, I said, after the water had settled in my stomach. I remembered how, for lack of a boy child, in spite of his saddening memories of the war, Papi used to take the señora hunting with real rifles when she was only a girl. With Papi, the hunt was for birds. With her husband, what would the mark be? Señor Pico guided his wife's hands along her rifle's trigger guard.
Remember, do not aim too high, or you will shoot over the head, he said.
He lined up her hands to fire once more. She shook her body free, leaned forward, lowered her eyes to the top of the gun barrel, then pulled the trigger. A calabash cracked from the tree across the yard and fell, toppling a few smaller ones on its way to the ground. Señora Valencia lowered her rifle to her side and said, "No mas." With a towel draped over her shoulder, Juana brought out a large bowl of water. The señora washed her hands and wiped them dry with the part of the towel that fell down to Juana's stomach.
"You must know how to protect yourself,"
Señor Pico said, as they walked back to the house. He held his wife by the arm, as though they were reliving their wedding march.
"Papi and Luis would be here to look after Rosalinda and me," she said.
"They cannot be with you at every moment," he said.
"We have never had these fears before," she said.
"This is a different time," he told her.
Luis came into the parlor to announce that a truck full of guardia had arrived. Juana rushed off and came back with Rosalinda, cradled in the arms of one of Señora Valencia's distant cousins, who had come from Igwe to visit the baby. Her name was Lydia. Lydia had a narrow face with slanted downcast eyes and shoulder-length black hair that swayed back and forth as she patted Rosalinda's behind. Lydia stepped forward and held Rosalinda out to be embraced by her father. Señor Pico avoided the child and instead brushed his lips against the side of Lydia's face before springing out the door. As he marched down the hill to one of the open-back trucks, the men of the Guardia saluted and cheered his approach. He waved to his wife one last time, then jumped into the passenger seat next to the driver.
"It almost seems like we are at war,"
Señora Valencia said, watching her husband's three-truck military caravan pull away. She chose to ignore his avoidance of their daughter and of herself, as she did all the other things he did that were not pleasing to her.
"With your man, everything is the great expedition."
Papi walked back to the parlor with the señora.
"Men like him have their names on plaques, on roads and bridges. Cities and villages are named for them. I came to live here in this valley because I wanted to escape such dealings, escape from armies and officers.
But your daughter loved the first soldier who strolled through your garden."
"Love cannot always be explained,"
Papi said, his voice filled with a desire to understand.
"I have seen this before, your man. He believes that everything he's doing for his country. At least this is what he must tell himself."
"He's a good man, Papi,"
the señora said.
"If you say it, I must believe you,"
Papi replied.
"I'm going for a stroll now.
Take Luis with you,"
Señora Valencia said.
"No, no," Papi said. "This I do alone."
25. The valley's dust storms bring me joy. The dust rises and funnels from the ground and sweeps down the road. Like a sheet come undone from the clothesline, it makes its own shadow, along with the birds that circle above, trying to spot the humans cowering with their heads mashed into their chests. In dust storms, I always imagine there are people walking ahead of me, people I cannot see, but whose forms I hope will emerge again once the air is cleared. I see my mother and father and myself. I am with them, a child who still must hold a hand to walk, a child who must look up to talk, to see all the faces. After the storm has cleared, I find myself with my hands raised up, in motionless prayer, as though some invisible giants were guiding me forward, my face tipped up towards the trees, covered with a veil of white loam. 26. Dr. Javier came by late in the afternoon to examine Rosalinda. Juana was in the pantry while Luis swept the yard outside. Dr. Javier seemed tired, his high shoulders drooping as he entered the house.
"Please listen to me," he whispered in Creole. "You must leave this house immediately. I have just heard this from some of the friends at the border. On the Generalissimo's orders, soldiers and civilians are killing Haitians. It may be just a few hours before they reach the valley."
It couldn't be real. Rumors, I thought. There were always rumors, rumors of war, of land disputes, of one side of the island planning to invade the other. These were the grand fantasies of presidents wanting the whole island to themselves. This could not touch people like me, nor people like Eve, Sebastian, and Congo who worked the cane fields. They were giving labor to the land. The Dominicans needed the sugar from the cane for their cafecitos and dulce de leche. They needed money from the cane.
"Is Pico here?" the doctor asked.
"He went to the border,"
I said. "Oh, the border," he said, as though this was the final sign he needed to confirm his tale.
He was trying to make me see the truth in the pellets of sweat on his face, his knotted brows and hurried gestures urging me to trust him if I wished, believe him if I could. He had many more people to speak to besides myself.
"Will you go?"
he asked. I wanted to have had more warning. I needed to know precisely what was true and what was not. Everything was so strange. What if the doctor too was part of the death plot? "I cannot leave my man and his sister," I said.
"A large group is crossing with me tonight," he said. "We have two trucks. I can make a place for them. We'll gather in front of the chapel. I've already spoken to Father Woman and Father Vargas. They are celebrating an evening mass for Santa Teresa. It is almost her time. We will make it seem as if everyone is coming to mass." I knew nothing about this Santa Teresa. Perhaps it would help me to know more about these saints that Juana adored, that this whole valley seemed to adore. Señora Valencia appeared in the long corridor, leading to her room.
"Why do you whisper, Javier?"
the señora asked.
"I didn't know if your daughter was sleeping," the doctor said. "If she was, I did not want to wake her."
"My daughter is a deep sleeper," the señora said proudly. Then she turned to me, with her fingers buried in her hair, scratching her scalp. She asked, "Amabel, has Puppy returned?"
"Help me, señora," I wanted to say. But what could she do? How much did she know? Would she be brave enough to stand between me and her husband if she had to?
"I'm uneasy about Poppy strolling for this long," she said, before showing the doctor to the room where Rosalinda was sleeping.
I tried to think of a plan. Be calm, I told myself. I had to act calmly. Just in case the doctor was right, I went to my room, sewed one of my skirts at the waist, made it into a sack, and threw a few things into it. Congo's mask of Joel's face, Sebastian's unfinished shirt from the day the Signora's children were born, and one change of clothing. If the doctor was wrong, I could always return. There was no harm in being prepared. I walked down the hill and hid the bundle in a narrow gap between the banana trees in the lush grove behind Juana and Luis's house, and then went back to the main house. Señora Valencia was in the parlor with the doctor.
Papi still hasn't returned? She asked.
No, señora.
Please tell Luis to go look for him.
First he would go to the chapel, Luis said, where Papi sometimes prayed. Then he would go to the cemetery, where Papi might be visiting his wife, his son, and his grandson's graves. There was no need to be anxious about Papi's wandering, but if the signora wanted him to go in search, this is what he would do. I followed Luis out as if to help look for Papi, but I went to find Sebastian instead. He had just returned from the fields. His entire body was soaked with perspiration, as though he was sweating through a fever. He leaned back against the wall to feel some of the cool air from outside. Papi's cedar panels were still in the room. I sat with Sebastian for a while without saying a word. I could tell that he was too tired to listen, and I did not want to speak until he was ready. Besides, I already didn't want to say to him what I had to say. I have found three places for you, Mimi, and me, in a truck crossing the border tonight, I said finally.
I've heard about the doctor's mass, he said. Santa Teresa, the little flower.
The doctor offered me work in a clinic, doing what my parents used to do, I said. I think it's best we go with him. If he is wrong, we can come back.
You never believed those people could injure you,
he said with a scowl that seemed truly hateful, as though he were talking to someone other than me.
Even after they killed Joel, you thought they could never harm you.
His hands were balled in fists, the way they always were when he tried to hold in his anger. I reached for the fists and opened them to see the palms where the lifelines had been rubbed away by the cane cutting. Perhaps I had trusted too much. I had been living inside dreams that would not go away, the memories of an orphaned child. When the present itself was truly frightful, I had perhaps purposely chosen not to see it. Forgive me, please, Sebastian, I said, for believing too much. He released the tightness of his fists to my grasp. My chest was cramping with a kind of fear I had known only once before, when my parents were drowning. An unstrung feeling as when a gust of wind pushed a door shut behind you, as if to trap you inside.
Let's talk to Congo, Sebastian said. He had a visitor in the fields this afternoon, the elder of your house.
Papi? He gave the field guards some money to let Congo go away with him, and Congo said yes. We went to Congo's room, where he was sitting with Eve. The two of them had a pile of almonds between them and were about to hammer them open. Congo looked as rested as if he had not been to the fields at all that day. On his lap were wicker strands arranged in piles to make a basket. Sebastian and I joined the circle around the wicker and almonds, as though they were objects to be worshipped.
Don Ignacio, Señora Valencia's father came to see you? I asked Congo. Do you know where he is now?
He said he was going to stroll a while before going back to his house. What did he want with you? Sebastian asked. He wanted to speak to me out in the woods, man to man, about my son, Congo replied. He was not worth your breath,
Eve said. His Adam's apple rose and fell several times faster when he was angry.
Only killing him would make things even.
Things are never even, Kongo said. If it was so, his life and my life would be the same.
What did he say?
Eve asked.
He asked me my son's name, Kongo said. Wanted to make a cross and write my boy's name on it, he did. He wanted to put the cross on my son's grave. I told him no more crosses on my boy's back.
You should have killed him and buried him in the woods,
Eve said.
He told me he killed people in a war when he was a young man,
Kongo said.
He couldn't remember how many he'd killed, but felt like each one was walking cut to cut with him, crushing his happiness. For his woman to die on the night his only son was to be born, for my son to be killed the day his grandchildren saw the first light, he felt this was the doing of the people he killed in the war. People still walking side by side with him. He thought his grandson's death showed this.
He wants you to carry your own sadness and his too?
Eve asked, his Adam's apple bulging against the thin skin covering it. Kongo reached over and tapped Eve's shoulder to calm him.
I want nothing more from him.
Kongo picked up a handful of almonds and pounded them with his fists to force them to surrender their kernels.
Misery makes us appear small, he said. But we are men. We spoke like men. I told him what troubled me, and he told me what troubled him. I feel perhaps I understood him a trace, and he understood me.
It's only a masquerade of kindness.
Eve got up and paced back and forth in front of the mat, where Joel had once slept.
Tonight, I sell the wood in our room.
Tonight, a truck is leaving, Sebastian said. Amabel, Mimi and me, we think of going.
All the same, I'm staying,
Eve said, running his fingers over his shaved head.
I'm selling the wood and I'm staying. There are many who believe the rumors are simply meant to chase us away.
Perhaps that is true, Sebastian said. But I wouldn't like to sit like a dog in cage if they are true.
What will you do?
Eve turned back to the old man.
I've been here 15 years now, Kongo said.
I'm too old for these types of journeys.
He reached into one of his pots and fished out a fistful of maize flour. Sprinkling the flour, he sketched a large letter V on the floor, each side spread far apart, like arms stretched out towards an invisible sky.
This is something my old grandfather used to do before I went on a journey, he explained. I make this mark for you, he used to say, because we're one, departing on two trails. Your trail is the trail of rivers and mountains, and on your journey you will require protection.
Sebastian and Eve both seemed sadly content, as though their dead fathers had come back to offer them a benediction. Kongo rubbed his hands together to brush off the maize flour once he was done. He looked up at us.
Like a Saint Christoph, he said.
Eve got up and left Kongo's room. When I looked outside a few moments later, I saw him heading towards the road in the dark with two of Papi's cedar planks on his back.
Wait for tomorrow,
Sebastian shouted as he rushed after him.
Tomorrow you may not be here.